How's everybody doing? Thank you for the invitation, Rabbi Center, and thank you for arranging this to Rabbi Goldberg and Mazel Tov, and to the Goldberg family, and thank you all for choosing to spend a little bit of your afternoon with me. I'm sure you have other options, or maybe you don't. I don't know. I'm not sure how it works in a military camp. So I am a plaintiff's personal injury attorney, which means that I represent people who get injured in truly horrifying ways. It was tough for me to even watch two guys zipping by on the golf cart because I've had multiple cases involving bad injuries on golf carts, so hold on tight when you're on that. I made a choice many years back that I was going to wear my yarmulke throughout my career, and so I find myself in all sorts of different situations, whether it's meeting clients or defense attorneys or judges or adjusters wearing it. And so I wanted to take you through some of those experiences about what it's like to be visibly Jewish in the workplace, because this will come up sooner than you think. Of course, some of you may stay in learning your entire careers, but on average, from what I'm told, like the Chazal say, it's about 1 in 1,000 who spend their entire career there. So which means that 999 out of 1,000 end up in the workplace, and so this may be premature, but on the other hand, you can blink and find yourself in that kind of situation. So I want to start with a story from when I was a kid, and we'll use it as like a reference point. So we'll put this one up on the blackboard. So I was around 10, 11 or so, plus or minus, growing up in Philadelphia. So that will tell you which teams I root for. Football has not been kind to us thus far in the season. And I hope they can hear. Can you hear way back there? You sure? Okay. If you can't, just start waving and I'll try to yell. So I got permission from my mother to take my next two younger siblings, myself, to 7-Eleven to get Slurpees, which was a big deal. I'm only 11. My next younger sister is 10. Next younger brother was 7 or so. You have to cross a couple streets. I'm on my own, so fine. My mother gives me a dollar or two, however much it cost way back when in the 70s to buy a few Slurpees. And we cross the first street. We're walking up the block. And the next thing I know, there are these teenagers. I'm only 11 or 12 or so, much bigger than I am, three guys, and they're yelling at us. What are they yelling? And I realize they're yelling something about Jews, Jewish, because my brother and I are wearing our yarmulkes. And in Philadelphia, in the area where we lived, that was not as common as the areas where probably most of you are from, where, you know, everybody in the block is wearing a yarmulke and everybody you see is wearing a yarmulke. It was uncommon. And then so it was a little, you know, strange what was going on. And then they started throwing pennies at us, which was even weirder. And so eventually we made our way to the 7-Eleven, got the Slurpees, went home. My mother says, how did it go? I said, fine. My sister says, you know, tell her about those teenagers. And anybody who has a younger sister know what I'm talking about. I was like, shut up. My mother's like, what teenagers? I said, well, whatever. They were like yelling at us. Like, why were they yelling at you? I don't know, something about Jewish. And then they're throwing pennies at us. So my mother had a look on her face I'd never seen before. And so she said, look, there are people out there, you may have heard about this before, that don't like Jews. And I said, but why were they throwing pennies at us? So she said, because they like to say that Jews are cheap. My personality, maybe because I'm from Philadelphia, you know, most people say, when life throws you lemons, make lemonade. In Philadelphia, we say, when life throws you lemons, freeze them and throw them back. Okay, that's what we're like in Philadelphia, right? The land of Rocky Balboa, etc. So my personality, maybe from my father, is that when somebody starts up with me, I want to give it back. But I was a little kid. Like, what am I going to do? I'm going to challenge. I'm 11. I'm going to challenge three 16, 17-year-olds to a fight. There was nothing I could do. So the only thing I could think of to do to show them up was to pick up the pennies and put them in my pocket. So I then understood, much to my incredible embarrassment, I can still remember being that little kid, how mortified I was. That's why they were laughing even louder, like, look, the cheap Jew, he's picking up the pennies. And always stay with me. So I always know, I'm always conscious of the fact that I am representing. And it bothers me often when I meet people, since I'm an out-of-towner from New York, who often don't realize that you're representing, right? There's a phrase in the Gemara. It's called the Tzurba Me Rabbana. It means the young rabbis. You know who that is? You know who that is, guys? The Tzurba Me Rabbana? When you walk out on the street, that's you. You're the young rabbis. You'll say, what do you mean? I'm not a rabbi. I'm just here in yeshiva. To the outside world, you walk out on the street in your white shirt, your yarmulke, and your tzitzis, and some of you with beards, you're a rabbi. Okay? We'll talk about this a little later. So just leave that up on the blackboard. So fast forward. I come out of Columbia as an undergrad. I get accepted to Harvard for law school. I decide I got to figure out where I'm holding with respect to my Yiddishkeit, certain things I'm doing. I don't know why I'm doing them. You know, I went to day school, but didn't really learn that much. Certain things I'm not doing, maybe I should do them. I find this place in Eretz Yisrael, Ur Sameach, and it's unbelievable. And for the first time, I get very, very serious about my Yiddishkeit. I spend the second year there. I defer a second year. Come back during that second year. I got went to a Sixers-Knicks game with a young woman that I knew and had been dating. Suddenly, there's a timeout in the first quarter, and it says up on the giant board, you know, Amy, will you marry me, Harry? Even more shockingly, she says yes. And so we get engaged, we get married, and I start law school. So there I am. This is in the fall of 1990, and I have been in yeshiva for the last 2 years, so I'm a little out of practice in my secular academic career. And I sit there, and it's my first year, first day, first class at Harvard Law School. And of course, I'm wearing my yarmulke. I'm even prouder than I was when I was younger. And I made my decision, and I'm going to wear my yarmulke proudly in law school. There were a few other people who were wearing their yarmulkes there. And so the professor comes in. He introduces himself, Professor David Wilkins, young, dynamic professor. He's still there. Now he's probably, you know, an older, dynamic professor. And he says, how many of you have seen the movie Paper Chase? Every single hand goes up in the room. How many of you have read the book 1L? Every hand goes up in the room. Paper Chase was this famous movie. They turned it into a TV show. It was about Harvard Law School. And the star was this professor who would just absolutely destroy people. Like, would call on people and would humiliate them so badly there was like nothing left. It was like a puddle where like the Wicked Witch of the West used to be in The Wizard of Oz. 1L was the first book that Scott Turow wrote before he became famous for writing legal thrillers. And it chronicled his experience as a first-year law student. In college, as a freshman, sophomore, junior, senior, in law school, 3 years, you're a 1L, 2L, 3L. My daughter is now a 3L. Chances are she'll join the family business. There are a couple of Rothenbergs there. There's my dad, my mom, there's me, the next younger sister, next younger brother, next younger sister, next younger brother, next younger brother, next younger sister. There are, if you're counting, there are 9 of us in the firm, so she may join. So 1L was Scott Turow's first book, talked about his first year at Harvard Law School, where the professor would do things like this. He would look at 3 people, and he would say, I want you 3 to look at each other, because by the time we get to graduation, only 1 of you is still going to be here. Like, pretty intimidating, right? Your first day, like 2/3 are going to fail out. He said, I want you all to know, there may well have been a time when it was like that here. It no longer is. We are not here to embarrass you. We're not here to intimidate you. We're not here to humiliate you. It's a different world now. We're here to educate you. At times, we may even entertain you. So relax. And you could like feel in the room like, okay, that sounds much better than what we saw in the movies and what we read. He said, however, we're going to use the Socratic method. It's named after Socrates, the famous Greek philosopher. I'm going to ask a question. I'm then going to call on a guinea pig. I mean a volunteer, one of you, and you're going to answer, and then I'm going to ask another question. Question, answer, question, answer. And I'm thinking to myself, I think the Rabbanim invented that. I think we invented that. I don't think it was Socrates, but fine. Socrates, Socratic method, fine, okay? He's okay. Let's begin your legal education. Now, at that point in time, all I'm thinking is I'm sitting there in the second row in this beautiful auditorium on the campus in Cambridge. I'm thinking, I do not want to be the first guy called on. I've been in yeshiva the last 2 years. It's been a while since I've been in my secular academic career. Let somebody else be the first guinea pig. So everybody knows what you do if you don't want to be called on. Like if I was about to call on somebody in the room, right, and you didn't want to be called on, what would you do? You would immediately look anywhere else but at me, right? Because if you look at me, you might look eager. So I am sitting there, and I am looking at my whatever, my notebook. I haven't written anything down yet, okay? Because I know what's coming. He's about to call on somebody. Now in college, your first day, meet and greet. Where's everybody from? What'd you do for your summer? In law school, you've been assigned readings even before the first class. So when you walk in, you have to be ready to answer questions. We had one professor who just walked in, there wasn't even a hello. Like literally walked in the room, Mr. Rothenberg, whoever it was, you know, she called on, just boom, started asking questions. You may have heard of her. Her name was Professor Elizabeth Warren. She's become a little more famous since then. So I don't want to be the first guy called on. There was a guy who was a 3L when I was a 1L. He was in his third year. I used to see him playing basketball in the gym, not a bad ball player. Stupidly, I never thought to take my basketball and a Sharpie and say, hey, dude, do me a favor, can you autograph this? Had I done that, I'd have had a basketball autographed by, pretty cool, a future president of the United States of America. I didn't know that that dude, Barry Obama, that I used to see in the gym, who was a couple years ahead of me, was going to go become the president of the U.S. So you have that kind of student there. Maybe Obama's first year was raising his hand to be the first guy called on. I don't want to be called on first. So Professor Wilkins starts pacing. He says, okay, let's begin. Who can tell me? What did the Wilson court say about non-mutual defensive collateral estoppel? Now, I'm sitting in the second row, and I see, I can't help but see, even though I'm looking down rigidly, his shadow is on my notebook, and I'm thinking, this may not end well. And he says, okay, how about you, Mr. Jew? You're the expression, the Korach, like the earth opened up and I fell in. I can't believe, he said he wasn't going to embarrass us? He wasn't going to humiliate us? He calls me Mr. Jew because I'm wearing a yarmulke on my head? Like, I can't, isn't that discrimination? I can't, and I don't even remember what the question is. When all of a sudden, the guy sitting directly in front of me starts answering the question. The Asian fellow, Thomas Jew, J-O-O. The best part about the story is it's exactly how it happened. So I admit, okay, as the Sara Mashkim said, Chata'ayani Mazkirayom, I recall my sins today, for sure, during the 2.5 seconds that it took Tom Jew, great guy by the way, to clear his throat and start answering the question, I absolutely was saying to myself, why'd I have to wear my beanie? Could have worn my Eagles hat, my Flyers hat, my Sixers hat, my Phil's hat. What was I thinking? I regretted my decision to be visibly Jewish in the workplace for the first time. It was back in 1990. We're in 2020 now. For the first time and the last time. That was the only time that I ever regretted that decision. Because instead, what I have seen is that time and time and time again, Baruch Hashem, that I made that decision to represent. So I want to share with you a couple examples of this, of why it's so important. First, it's important because it sets a safeguard. It sets a safeguard for you when you have to face temptation. So I'll give you an example. I'll give you a small example. Nowadays, there you'll know, Hamev and Yavin, that this is just the tip of the iceberg with respect to this type of temptation. So I'll give you my daily day. I'm in my office, or at least I used to be. Now, because of the virus, I'm there every couple of days. Other days, I'm working remotely. And so our receptionist gets the mail. She opens it. She puts it in piles for each different lawyer, and then she brings it all to me because I want to review everything, not because I'm a yenta, but because I may see something. Hey, wait a minute. I didn't realize there's more coverage on this case. I may need to look into that case more carefully, even though I'm not handling it. One second. There's a motion here. I may leave a note to one of the lawyers. You know, I had a motion like this before. I have a brief on this. Come see me. So I want to look at it, and then I give it out or give it back to her to give out to everybody. So I get all the mail. We subscribe to Sports Illustrated because we have a waiting room, and sometimes you could have people show up. Maybe they don't have a phone. Maybe their phone dies, whatever. Maybe they just want to read something. So we subscribe to Sports Illustrated and one or two other magazines because we have a waiting room. Sometimes we'll have a deposition. Somebody, a home health aide, will show up with someone. They're sitting in my waiting room for 6 hours. So we need to have reading material. I'm a sports fan. So we subscribe to SI. You're probably familiar with it. And once a week, she brings it in. And while I'm eating my 7-minute lunch, I'll flip through, you know, read an article or two. Once a year, there's one article, there's one issue that she does not bring to my office, okay? And it's the most popular issue by far. It's not the NFL preview, it's not the NBA preview, it's not the MLB preview. You could probably guess what it is. It is a certain issue featuring women mostly not wearing bathing suits. It's their famous swimsuit issue. She removes it from the mail. We have a non-Jewish filing clerk. That is one of his bonuses, in addition to a financial bonus that he gets at the end of the year. He gets that issue, enjoy, etc. Now, why doesn't she bring that issue to my office? So if you ask her, she'll tell you, well, of course I don't bring that issue because Harry's religious and he doesn't want to see that. And she's extremely respectful because often I will do, or at least I used to, hopefully I'll be able to do this again soon, I'll often do a lunch and learn, and sometimes I'll do one that's text-based. So I'll give out handouts. So I'll say to her, do me a favor. I'll take in my Chumash, my Gemara, et cetera. I'll say, you know, the places where I put a little sticky, you know, make run off 25 copies of each page. When she brings those Sfarim back to me, It's like the Queen's Guard in England delivering the Magna, like the original copy of the Magna Carta. Like she's incredibly, you know, reverential with respect to things like that. And she's 100% right. I don't want that issue in my office because I don't want to see it because I'm from. There's another reason. The other reason is, the reason I don't want her to bring it into my office is that I really want to see it. I really want to see it. There's a reason that that issue is the most popular issue every year. Why? Because men, last time I checked, I'm one of them, like to look at those types of pictures, right? So if it's in my office, I know I'm going to face temptation. And I know that there's going to come a time during the day when my door is going to close, personal call, whatever it is going to be sometime during the day, maybe it's during lunch, right? And if the door closes, I know. Not only am I going to face temptation, I'll be able to convince every one of you, not that I'm allowed to look at that issue. I have to look at that issue. You know why? I'm going to tell you why. Number one, Bar Raffaelli, one of the models, is Jewish. I have to check that she's in there. Because if not, that could be anti-Semitism. Why aren't you allowing the Yid, you know, in the magazine? I got to check that out. Number two, Gore-Tex is an Israeli manufacturer of women's bathing suits. So I got to make sure, because that's what I'm going to look at, the fine print, that there are Gore-Tex bathing suits there. Otherwise, is Sports Illustrated participating in BDS, like in against Israel? I got to check that out. Meaning I'll come up with reasons why, etc. So we all know what I'm talking about. That's the tip of the iceberg. Now with the internet, you're laughing. Magazine, you think that's the temptation? So it reminds us, okay, to try to set up safeguards. Here's a bigger example, a work example. A woman, 42 years old, was crossing the street in the city, 65th and Madison, and the little man turns white. She was doing her nightly power walk. So when the little man turns white, that tells her that it's okay to cross. So she starts crossing. Now we know when that light turns white for people crossing, the pedestrians, it means that the light for traffic, vehicular traffic for vehicles, turns green. So a bus is coming and wants to make a left-hand turn. So she's walking, she's halfway across the street. The bus goes to make a left-hand turn, it's coming from behind her. So she never sees it. So she has no chance. So the bus goes through, for whatever reason doesn't see her, hits her, kills her, and keeps going. It's a hit and run. There's an eyewitness. The eyewitness tells the police officer that it was a blue and white bus. Mazel tov, blue and white bus. Is that the city of New York? Is it Greyhound? Is it Academy? Is it Bolt? Is it nine other bus companies? What am I gonna do? Who am I suing? Blue and white bus. So I need that eyewitness to tell me which bus company it is. Here's the difference. If we do not have a bus company, the only thing we can do is we can bring a claim against her husband's policy. She was married. No children, but she was married. Her husband's policy had something called uninsured motorist coverage, which if in a hit-and-run type situation or if it's a stolen vehicle or somebody doesn't have insurance, you could bring a claim against your own insurance policy. Not so well known. It's important to take a look at that area in your policy. You can explain that to your parents. So that's all he's got, $250,000 worth of coverage if we don't find the bus. If we find the bus, every one of those bus companies that I named has massive amounts of insurance because bus companies know when a bus gets into a fight with a person, the bus usually wins. So they have crazy amounts of insurance on buses. Here's what I could ask for under New York law. Gentlemen and ladies up there of the jury, I can ask for an award, if we find the bus company, for the conscious pain and suffering that she endured, very little. By the time the ambulance got there, she was already dead at the scene. But there must have been some. It wasn't instantaneous. She wasn't zapped by an alien spaceship. There had to be some degree of pain. I can ask for loss of consortium. That's the fancy way of saying that her husband lost her as a wife. And then I can also ask for something called pecuniary loss, which is a fancy way of saying that I can ask for lost wages. Her lost wages. So at the time, this 42-year-old woman was working on a street in Lower Manhattan you may have heard of. It's called Wall Street, trading bonds, making at the time $1 million a year. $1 million a year. So let's say, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, just conservatively, forget raises, forget cost of living increases, just $1 million she was making, let's say she would have worked conservatively another 20 years, till 62. I'm not going to try to convince you that she would have worked till her 70s, just 62, 20 years, $1 million a year. That's $20 million. And will you award, will you give me another $1 million for the conscious pain and suffering, even though it was limited, and for the loss of consortium? That's a $21 million verdict that I'm looking at. My fee, unlike most lawyers, I don't bill by the hour. I don't get anything on a case until the end. At the end of the case, I take a third. So I can divide any number by three. The bigger the number, the quicker I can do it. It's weird. I don't know why that is. So I'm looking at the potential for a $7 million fee versus a third of 250 grand. If this knucklehead would just tell me which bus company. So I send people to talk to him, investigators. And he says, look, I don't know. I have no speak of language. Don't want to get involved. Whatever it is, he says, won't tell us. So let me ask you. Suppose I had gone, you've been listening to me speak for a little bit, right? Don't you think I could have been convincing enough to sit with him, eye to eye, man to man, mano a mano? Sir, I represent the husband of the woman whom you saw get killed. You're the only witness. You're the only chance he has of getting the recovery he deserves. Which bus company? Don't you think I could have convinced him to cooperate? And the answer is, of course not. I sent an ex-FBI agent to the guy. I sent people who were trained, multiple investigators, at interrogating. The guy either didn't know or wasn't going to cooperate. But what if I had sat with him, face to face, man to man, and said, you just can't remember? Isn't there anything I can do to help refresh your recollection? No, Mr. Rothenberg. There's nothing I can do. There's no way that I can help you remember what happened. Nothing. There's no possible way that I can help you remember. You tell me. You tell me. How much would I have had to stick in an envelope? The guy did not live in a nice area in New York. A grand, $3,000, five large, $10,000 in cash in an envelope. You don't think this guy would have been willing to swear on a stack of Bibles? It was Academy bus. Okay, anybody want to do that deal with me? You give me 10 grand, I'll give you back $7 million. So of course the thought went through my mind. But I remind myself that here's the problem. We're going to get the depositions. At the deposition, the other lawyer is of course going to ask him, you told the police officer blue and white bus. Then you told Rothenberg it was Academy. What happened? Now hopefully he's going to say, I remembered it was Academy. Remember, I paid good money for that testimony. But what if he says, George Washington, right? Style. I can't tell a lie. Mr. Rothenberg paid me to say it was Academy. So what happens? So first of all, I probably get suspended from the practice of law. And I've disgraced my firm. But big deal in big deal, not that those aren't big deals, they're big deals, but much bigger deal. I have disgraced the Jewish people. Because you better believe that when that hits the papers, they're not going to put a picture of me standing in front of law books. They're going to find a picture of me with my tallis and tefillin on, okay? Like that is going to be the article. You're laughing, okay? You're laughing. You ready? I got two articles to prove my point. Robert Kraft, the owner of the Patriots, was arrested and accused of something. I don't want to say what it was. It's not pleasant what he was accused of not too long ago. Here's an article from USA Today. Robert Kraft, accused of whatever it was, gave hundreds of millions to charitable causes. And that's a very weird title for an article. It caught my attention. In USA Today, I was traveling, so it's the paper of choice in a lot of hotels. Here we go. Just weeks ago, before Robert Kraft won his sixth Super Bowl as owner of the Patriots, he was awarded perhaps a greater honor. The Genesis Prize is given to leaders of Jewish heritage, quote, who have attained international renown in their chosen professional fields, and, quote, have made a significant contribution to improving the world. It's sometimes called the Jewish Nobel Prize. I'm going to continue. A Democrat, he is a longtime friend of President Donald Trump. He visited the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh last year following the mass shooting there that killed 11. Why is that relevant to what he was arrested for down in Florida? A vocal supporter of Israel, Kraft has taken NFL players to the Jewish state on trips sponsored by the league. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is scheduled to present the prize to Kraft in June. Comes with $1 million to be donated to Jewish causes. A spokeswoman for the Genesis Prize did not respond to messages from USA Today. It continues. Kraft also supports Judaic studies programs at Brandeis University, the alma mater of his late wife, and has supported Jewish programs at Columbia University, his own alma mater. Neither school responded to requests for comment. So I sent this hit piece to a friend of mine who is a massive Patriots fan and who I knew was going to go crazy over this. So he sent me later that day the email that he sent to the person that wrote this article, because they had, nowadays you can actually write directly because they'll often include their email address. So here's a copy of the email that he sent to this writer. Subject, Kraft piece. Nice job of revealing yourself as a classic anti-Semite. Next time, make it easier. Just write, quote, Bob Kraft, accused of whatever it was, is a Jew, Jew. I think that would do the job just as effectively and require fewer words. Keep up the good work. Okay? Now, Kraft, you'll say, well, maybe the reason they went after him is that even though he doesn't walk around with a yarmulke, he is really identifiable. He is kind of out there. He gives a lot of money to Jewish causes. So maybe that's why they went after him. Here's another one. Michael Cohen, Trump's former lawyer, went to jail. Now, you try to find me an article that ever talked about Michael Cohen eating kosher food or going to shul or celebrating Simchas Torah or davening nates, okay? It doesn't exist. It's just not something that was a part of his life. But he goes to jail, so here's the article. Trump's former lawyer heads to U.S. prison that offers matzah ball soup and full-time rabbi. Oh, this is just going to be great, okay? With a menu that includes matzah ball soup and gefilte fish, as well as a full-time rabbi and a chance at the occasional visit home, the U.S. prison where Donald Trump's former personal lawyer will spend the next 3 years is unique in the federal system. The 52-year-old Cohen will be housed in dorm-like accommodations at the facility's minimum security camp, which prison consultants say has become a destination for Jewish inmates due to its proximity to New York City's Jewish and upstate New York's Orthodox Jewish enclaves. He's going to what I like to refer to as, quote, Jewish heaven, said the founder of Wall Street Prison Consultants. Jewish heaven. It's a jail. Former manager of the prison, who now runs a prison consulting firm, said the camp was, quote, a great place for white-collar Jewish guys. Where do I sign up? Like, is there a waiting list? How do I get into this? Sounds even better than this place. I mean, it sounds fantastic, right? Unlike most federal prisons, which periodically bring in part-time contract rabbis, Otisville has a full-time rabbi, this guy says. Another thing that sets Otisville apart is the food. Quote, the availability for kosher food is much greater, said another former inmate who founded Jail Time Consulting. The commissary menu on Otisville's website advertises, your mouth's going to start watering, you ready? Matzo ball soup, gefilte fish, and rugelach, alongside Doritos, tortilla chips, and Diet Sprite soda. Whatever. Kosher items are marked throughout with the letter K. Now, what is the point of this article? The point is that if you do something wrong as a Yid, whether your yarmulke's on or not, it's going to be out there and you're going to disgrace the Jewish people. And we know that those of us who are wearing the yarmulke, they don't need to search for it. We are advertising it. We are walking advertisements, right? If you do not hold the elevator door open for someone, if you cut someone off, if you, you know, whatever, any kind of interpersonal reaction, it's not just that guy. If you're wearing your baseball cap, unless you're, you know, God willing, you should all meet your bashert, you know, when you're, by the way, just, you know, hint, when you're wearing your baseball cap and you're standing next to your wife with her long sleeves and skirt and shaitel, people are probably going to also figure out that you're from, just newsflash, right? So when you're doing that, it's the Jew did that to me. You got to be careful about that. And I will tell you that there are a few things that are more rewarding when you do the right thing and you realize you're repping the Jewish people. I am a very big Phillies fan. And I will tell you that after 9/11 was, I don't have to tell you how horrifying it was. You guys aren't old enough to remember it. Some people in the room are, but it was beyond horrifying, and there were no sports. I mean, who's playing ball the night of, and it took some time. I don't know how long it took, 2 weeks, whatever it took, plus or minus, until they had the first game. When the first game that was played, Mike Piazza, the old catcher for the Mets, and I can't stand the Mets, but I will tell you that when he stepped out on the field wearing the logo of the NYPD on his helmet, showing the world, I am representing those guys, those warriors, okay, the blue lives that are now under fire, but then, you know, people were supporting, it really was a big deal. And you guys have that chance. It's a big deal when you have a chance to properly represent the Jewish people. And you have the ultimate paradigm staring at you in the Torah. You have a guy in the Torah who goes through these types of situations, not exactly for you, but similar situations, who's screaming out to you because the things that he does are ridiculous, completely ridiculous. There's this fellow named Yosef, who happens to be my favorite character in Tanakh, and Yosef shows up, he comes down to Mitzrayim. This nice Jewish boy, Jewish population of Mitzrayim, 2. The other one, you know, through the measures is Asnas, Potiphar's adopted daughter. Okay, fine. But basically, it's him. He's the Yid in the whole country. So he shows up. Okay? And when he shows up, we see that we're told that Potiphar, his boss, who, by the way, happened to be the chief executioner in Egypt, wonderful job for a nice 17-year-old Jewish boy, Torah says that his master saw that Hashem was with him. So Rashi tells us, how did he know that? Because he would constantly mention the name of Hashem. We know those types of people, right? Hey, how you doing? Baruch Hashem. Hey, what are you doing today? In Yirtz Hashem. Okay, like Yosef, you're in Egypt. You're the only Yid there. Like, it's a little weird. It's a little weird, okay? Now, his master's wife starts up with him, and he says to her, listen, of course he says, how can I betray my master, right? He's trusted me, your husband, Potiphar. And then he goes on to say, how can I do such a terrible thing and sin against God? Now, what do you think Potiphar's wife, this idolater, is saying? Oh, I didn't realize that. Oh, God, yeah, that would be a big problem. I didn't think of that, God, okay? And here's where it gets really crazy. When it gets really crazy is that when the wine minister gets out of jail, he tells Paro, of course, he forgot about him the last 2 years because he's an opportunist, but now he sees Paro's very upset about his dreams. He's, oh, by the way, you know, I'm just remembering now when I was in jail, there was this kid with us. He was a slave, a Jew. How does he know that Yosef's Jewish? Because apparently when Yosef got to the dungeon in Egypt, he asked for the kosher meal plan. Now, I'm telling all of you, if you ever get captured and thrown in an Egyptian dungeon, they don't like us now, they didn't like us then, okay? You don't just, I'm telling you this, if the Rabbanim want to disagree with me, please, I will defer, okay? But it might be wise, instead of saying your last name's Rothenberg, it's Robinson. Instead of Schwartz, maybe just say it's Smith, okay? Maybe count 7 days, tell them you're vegan, eat the vegetables. I mean, for crying out, could you just wake me up for Nate's and also, you know, Friday afternoon, we're going to have to figure out the schedule. He's in an Egyptian dungeon, introducing himself as a Yid. Is he crazy? And then the last one, Paro calls him up out of the dungeon. Paro says to him, you know, I hear that you have this ability to go interpret dreams. Dude, just say, how can I help you, Your Excellency? Instead, the first words out of mouth to Paro is, he contradicts him. He says, not me. Hashem, God will respond, you know, to Paro. Like, his head should be rolling in the gutter. So I think maybe the reason he's doing that is to scream out from the pages of the Chumash that, guys, I'm telling you, the reason I stuck my neck out is to show you that no matter what your job is, be a proud Yid. Even if you're working for a chief executioner in Egypt. No matter who your significant other is in your social life, be a proud Yid. No matter where you're living, whatever, you know, apartment or dorm, etc., in whatever city, be a proud Yid. And don't tell me that your boss, listen, how can I wear my yarmulke at my work, my boss? There's just no way. Your boss? No way? How about Paro? Is your boss worse than Pharaoh? Because that would be an awfully bad boss if he's worse than Pharaoh. He's screaming it out at us that we can do this. I have another story. And it's a difficult one to tell over. What's our timing? What's it? No. Is it, what's that? No. I'm saying until when do I? 6:45. Oh, okay. Then before that story, then I'll tell you some. I'll give you a couple examples of how careful you have to be while you're representing as the Tzur Meirabanan. So, I was driving once back home out of the city, and at the time, there was a shortcut into the tunnel. If you were on 10th Avenue, you could make a left onto 39th Street, but you had to be in one of the two leftmost lanes. So I was in one of those lanes about to make my left. The guy pulls up next to me. He's on the other side of this row of cones. See, he can't make the left. So all of a sudden, I see that the window goes down. His arm reaches out, lifts up a cone, takes it into his van. The window closes again. He now goes into the space that he's made, okay? And he drives through the Lincoln Tunnel ahead of me, right? Don Chav's chost that the next day on his way into the city, he rolled the window down and said, officer, I found this cone, I'd like to return it. Oh, incredible. Now, I said a tefillah as I saw this happen. And my tefillah was, Hashem, please let it be that I was the only guy that saw his yarmulke and beard when he did that. I mean, dude, like, I mean, that's why Hashem invented baseball caps. Like, if you're going to pull stunts like that, don't. But keep on in your car. Okay? Number two, I had a meeting with a Rav was coming to tell me about his organization, to collect in my office. And so it happened to be that I was out at lunch, so I was running a little bit late. So I was walking down the block as he was about to walk into my building. So he didn't see me, I saw him up ahead. So I see he did the Moshe Rabbeinu move, like when Moshe checked to make sure there was nobody around before he killed the Mitzri, like he looked each way. So he looked each way real quick, and then he threw a tissue down on the ground. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I mean, he was very identifiably a... Okay, if not a Rav, certainly identifiably a very from Yid, with the whole nine, with the full penguin costume, okay, including tzitzis out and beard, etc., okay? So we go up to my, so now I meet him in the lobby. I catch up to him. I say, oh, hey, let's go up together. And he's sitting, he's making his whole spiel, telling me about his, whatever it was, his organization. Sean, I don't remember what it was. And the whole time, I can't hear a word that he's saying because I'm sitting there saying, should I say something or not? If I say something, he's going to be completely embarrassed. But on the other hand, maybe I should let him know. If I don't say something so he can do it again, I mean, it's a chel Hashem. Like, you're right out there in Manhattan. How are you littering, looking like a... So I said, I got to say something. As uncomfortable as it was. So I said, I just need to tell you something. And you should just know that it's a sign of our friendship. Because if I didn't feel close enough to you, I don't know that I would have the courage to say it. So I just want to point out to you, I told him what I had seen. I said, I just, you know, you're on the street in Manhattan. And you have the full tzur of a, you know, of a hush of rav. Like, if somebody sees you, you know, littering, okay? I can't tell you. From his face, it was very clear to me. Since then, I am sure that if he was in the Sahara Desert holding an empty, you know, Coca-Cola can, he would carry it across the desert until he found the trash can. Like, there's no question once I brought it to his attention, all right? So you got to be careful, no matter what the situation. You must be careful. So here's the next story. This is going back into the 1970s in Philadelphia. There was a radical group. It was called MOVE. They were revolutionaries, or maybe they were counter-revolutionaries. I don't know. I don't know what the difference is. So they would walk around, to the extent they went outside, in combat fatigues, carrying assault rifles. They would be on bullhorns all hours of the day and night, just screaming craziness and obscenities in the neighborhood. They wouldn't let anybody in or out of their compound. They had this, like, fortified apartment building. And the mayor of Philadelphia, Frank Rizzo, was like, what is this? This is ridiculous. So he sent in a SWAT team. You know, he tried to get them out. They wouldn't come. Sent in a SWAT team. And they went in, you know, guns blazing. A couple people got hurt. There were some lawsuits, but he got rid of them. 10 years or so later, in the 80s, they're back. It's MOVE 2. Why anybody would get this idea again, I don't know. But again, the whole stuff with the fatigues and the guns and the bullhorns, and they're terrorizing the neighborhood. And so this time, the mayor, Wilson Good, says, look, you know, try to go in peacefully. I don't want to call in the SWAT team. So he sends in the cops. They get into a shootout. And then eventually there's some dispute as to who authorized this. They decide they're going to send a helicopter, a police helicopter, with military-grade explosives. They're going to drop it on the roof to start a fire because they're crazy, but they're not suicidal. Once the fire starts, they'll run out. And it's much easier to arrest somebody who's running out of a burning building than to go in through the front door in a shootout, you know, into hand-to-hand combat. So they drop it, starts the fire, they run out, the police jump on them, they arrest them. At least they arrest the ones that weren't burned alive in the building. They didn't realize they were storing fuel on the roof, so it created a massive fire, and a few of them were incinerated inside the building. And the fire burnt down an additional 60 homes, residences, apartment buildings in the neighborhood. Like, literally, the police burnt a neighborhood down. I can't even imagine what would happen if something like this happened nowadays. So we start getting phone calls to represent people who have been injured in the fire and also property damage claims, which normally we wouldn't take. It's not worth our while to go take somebody lost, I don't know, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 in the fire. Not worth our while. But because we got so many calls, we said, you know what? We'll handle them all together, and that way we'll just make them all part of one lawsuit. And so we'll take the injury cases and the property damage cases. Property damage cases get assigned to a young lawyer in our office named David, happens to be a from Yid. He's like, couple years out of law school, 26 years old or so at the time, something like that, plus or minus. And he's representing the people who have their property damage claims. You have to prove up the claims. Maybe you have to show pictures of what you had or receipts. You can't just say, I had a very fancy vase. It was from the Ming Dynasty and it's worth $10 million. Like, you got to, you know, prove it up. So he's trying to work on that with his paralegal. And he's getting a call every week or two from a very difficult client, Ernest Bostic, who lost all his belongings in an apartment that was burnt down. Mr. Bostic, you gotta be patient. There are a few hundred claims. We have like 100 of our own. It's gonna take time. It'll probably take a couple years. 2 weeks later, you know, what's going on? When am I getting my money? Mr. Bostic, you gotta be patient. Finally, Bostic calls one day. He says, Dave, I settled my case. Get me my money. He says, what do you mean you settled your case? He says, I spoke to so-and-so. He's the lawyer for City Hall. He says, you spoke to, and David says the name of the young attorney on the other side who's representing the city of Philadelphia, the assistant city solicitor. And he says, yeah, that's who I spoke to. He says, okay, I'll call him up. Calls him up. He said, hey, it's Dave from Rothenberg's office. Did you speak to my client, Ernest Bostic? The assistant city solicitor says, I'm so sorry. I made a mistake. I didn't realize he called me directly. I assumed he was pro se. Pro se means self-represented. That's a person who thinks that lawyering is like Home Depot. You just do it yourself. So since he called him directly, he didn't think to check his list because had he realized he's represented by an attorney, We all know that, right? You can't talk to somebody who's represented by a lawyer. So he says, Dave, I messed up. I shouldn't have spoken to him. He says, look, Dave says, look, it was an honest mistake. He called you directly. But let me get to the point. He said he settled his case with you for $10,000. Can I send you a release? He says, wait, I didn't settle the case with him. He says, well, why does he think you settled the case with him? He says, oh, no. Oh, I know what happened. Whenever I have a pro se litigant call me, I ask them, how much are you looking for? So he told me he's looking for $10,000, but I didn't settle with him. Dave says, listen, okay, you shouldn't have spoken to him. I know it was a misunderstanding. Can't we just settle this one case? Can I send you a release for $10,000 on this one case? The assistant city solicitor says, I'm so sorry. You know, there's no way. Like, you know how it works here. I got like 7 layers of authority above me. Like, I wouldn't even know who to go to. Like, you know how this is going to work. In 2 years, we'll sit down with a matrix, with a grid. This was before Excel. And we'll sit down and we'll work on all the cases. Dave says, there's no way. You can't make one exception. There's absolutely no way. Calls Bostic, gives him the bad news. Case isn't settled, and we're going to have to continue to litigate. Bostic hangs up the phone and says, okay, in that case, I'm going to go kill the lawyer at City Hall. So he buys a revolver with a sawed-off serial number. He goes to City Hall. He signs in 12:10 p.m. in Ernest Bostic. And he sits there 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes. I'm guessing that in City Hall, they're probably cheaper. They probably don't have a subscription to Sports Illustrated. Otherwise, he would have had something to flip through while he's sitting there. How long are you going to sit when a guy is out to lunch and you're waiting to kill him? So the answer is 20 minutes. He signs out 12:30 p.m. He leaves. And he later tells the police that he just figured that his lawyer must be in cahoots with the city, so he'll go kill him instead. So he comes to our office. He knows which floor David's on. He knows where his office is. He gets off the elevator, and as he's stepping off the elevator, David just happens to be walking by. And they make eye contact. He recognizes David. He pulls the gun. David turns and starts to run, and he empties the gun into David's back. 6 bullets, through and through. Entry wounds in his back, exit wounds in his front. David collapses in a pool of blood. The police arrive with some metal paddy wagon before the ambulance. My father is literally in the back of the paddy wagon holding David's head so it won't hit the metal floor of the wagon. They rush him into surgery with the chief trauma surgeon in Philadelphia, who does 14 hours worth of microsurgery and saves his life. It's absolutely mind-boggling. Saves his life. So 2 days later, at the time I'm probably 18 or so, I say, you know what, I'm going to go visit him. It's a nice thing to do. You know, he took 6 bullets, and I've met him before. It's, you know, it's my parents' firm. I've met him before. So I go to visit him. It's during the day. The only other people there are his parents, and his parents say, Harry, it's so nice of you to come. Do you mind? We just wanted to run out to get some food. You know, do you mind staying with David? I said, sure. That's why I came. So I sit next to him, and he says, he's very weak. And he says, I have to tell you a story. I said, no, it's fine. I just came to visit you. He says, no, I have to tell you a story. I said, okay. He says, yesterday, the doctor who did the surgery came to my room to introduce himself. He said, I'm like, how do you thank somebody who saved your life? So I tried to thank him. He said, I'm just doing my job. He said, but I want you to know I never do this. He said, do what? He said, I never come after a surgery. Sometimes somebody doesn't make it. They go to the morgue. Sometimes somebody survives. Like you, I don't visit them. I don't have any more doctor-patient relationship. As you know, Dr. So-and-so is following you. You're going to see him. I just had to come to tell you that I've never seen a case like yours. For 25 years, I've been doing these types of surgeries. I thought I had seen everything. I haven't. One of the bullets grazed your spinal cord. One of the bullets grazed your heart. Any closer, you'd have been dead or paralyzed. If you had moved differently, if you were wearing any different clothing, anything would have changed the trajectory and you'd have been dead or paralyzed. He said, so I just want to let you know, young man, you had a guardian angel who was watching you. And he left. I said, wow. He says, wait, there's more to the story, but I didn't tell the doctor because he wasn't Jewish. I said, yeah. He said, that morning I got into my car. And I put the key in and I turned it on. And all of a sudden I said to myself, wait a minute, did I put my tzitzis on today? And I went like this and I was like, I don't believe it. I forgot to put my tzitzis on. So I said to myself, Dave, you could go to work one day without your tzitzis on. So again, I put my foot on the accelerator. And then I said to myself, Dave, how can you go to work without your tzitzis on? So I turned off the car. I went back into my apartment. I took off my coat, took off my suit jacket, took off my tie, unbuttoned my shirt. I put my heavy wool pair of tzitzis on. Shirt back on, tie back on, jacket back on, coat back on, and I went to work. He said, Harry, the doctor said if I had done anything, I was like, Dave, I got it. Okay? I got it. I will tell you, I admit, that at the time when I was about 18, chances are I probably was not wearing my tzitzis when I heard that story. I will tell you that since that day, unless I am in the swimming pool or the shower, you can come check. You could do like the Rebbeim used to do when I was in day school, go like this, pretend they're giving you a little neck massage to check if you're wearing. Herschel, come here, let me pretend to give you a neck massage while checking if you're wearing your tzitzis, okay? Now, I'm obviously not telling you this story to suggest, guys, Kevlar body armor, okay? Maybe wear two pairs, Rav Scheinberg, maybe that's why he wore, you know, tzatzal, so many pairs. You'd laugh at me, right? Because you know there have been Israeli soldiers that have been killed, Nebuch, while wearing tzitzis. We know from Pittsburgh. In Pittsburgh, two of the guys who were in charge of like giving out the talisim in the temple, they were shot in Poway, okay? Like, I'm not suggesting that to you. What I am suggesting to you is this. David, the guy to whom it happened, was 100% convinced that he had done something extra for Hashem, and Hashem did something extra for him. Right? I'm just like, I imagine up in Shemayim, that like that day, that morning, when he got out of the car, like imagine Hashem going around to the Malachim, like, Uriah, Raphael, where's Mike? Where's Michael? Did you see what that guy just did? That guy just got undressed, put his tzitzis on, got redressed. Later today, when he needs me, I got this. But God, didn't you mention something about six bullets? I got this. Okay? So I'm suggesting to you that maybe if we do something extra for Hashem, he'll do something extra for us. And is that crazy? Imagine you are walking. You're on your campus. You have your, I don't know if anybody's walking around with knapsacks. Probably not, right? But back in the day, I used to walk around with a knapsack. Now, when I wear a knapsack, I'm much to the embarrassment of my kids, I wear it over both shoulders because I know about spinal S curvature as a personal injury attorney. They think that's extremely dorky. They wear it over one shoulder, no matter how many books they're carrying to school, I wear it over two. But most people wear it over one. So you're walking, you're not, you know, whatever, maybe you're on your cell, maybe you're not, somebody else is on their cell, they're not paying attention, and they're walking with their overhanging bag, or they're wheeling one of those killer, you know, duffel bags, wheeled bags, and they knock you to the ground, okay? You fall down to the ground. You get up, you turn around, and the person that knocked you down says, you got a problem? And what happens next, okay? I don't know about you. I'm from Philly. That's a fist fight. That's a fist fight. The guy knocks you down and like gives you lip. Are you kidding me, right? So now you finish whatever it is, your class, your meeting, etc. Now you're walking back again. And now some other knucklehead with the bag, the knapsack, or with the killer duffel bag, okay, knocks you down to the ground. As you're falling, you're thinking like, what is going on today, right? This time you jump up, you already got your fists made. Except this time the guy that knocked you down is running over. I'm so sorry. Can I help you up? I'm such a klutz. I feel terrible. I feel so bad. What's your reaction going to be? Maybe, at most, you'll say, just be more careful next time. At most, you might even just say, it's fine. Like, you know, it happens, okay? Goodbye. If somebody saw you on a silent movie, one of those old-time movies with no sound, they see the first time, you get knocked down, you get up, pound the guy into the pavement. Second time, you get knocked down, hey, no problem, you walk away. Like, well, schizophrenia? Like, what is going on? Why are those two different reactions? But for us, it's obvious why they're two different reactions. You're mirroring. The first guy was demanding, was aching for a break-in, cruising for a bruising. You gave it to him. The second guy acted perfectly appropriately. So why is it so crazy to think that if we do something extra out of our comfort zone for Hashem, that Hashem doesn't say, you did something extra for me, I'm going to do something extra for you. Something to think about, especially now on the eve of Yom Kippur. Do I have time for one more story or? Okay, last one. Then I'll let you go. So, one thing that's very important is that we have to understand that anytime something happens to us, particularly something out of the ordinary, it's a message for you. Whether you're directly involved, whether you saw it happen. I remember once I was on a trip and somebody suffered a horrific injury. And the tour, it was in Eretz Yisrael. This could only happen in Eretz Yisrael. And the tour guide got on the bus afterwards with the girl on the way to the hospital. He said, I want everyone to know, whether you got hurt, or just witnessed it, this was a message for each one of us. Each one of us is to a cheshbon nefesh. Like, why are we so close to it? Two of my young children were this close to getting very badly injured when it happened. And it was a very telling, memorable moment where he's like, okay, it's not just, you know, didn't happen to me, but it almost did. It was a message. So I had a case on behalf of a woman who was riding her bicycle next to the West Side Highway. She was jogging next to the West Side Highway, and she was crossing the bicycle path, and there was a bicyclist in his full Lycra, you know, Mad Max, leaning over the racing bike, and there was no eyewitness to what happened, but there was an ear witness, meaning there was another woman who didn't see it, but she heard the sound of my client getting hit by the bike and her head hitting the ground. So she turned around because she heard her head hitting the ground. We said, based on the doctor's reports, the many, many, many doctor's reports that our client, who had, from the client doctors that she had seen, that she had a traumatic brain injury. She had a concussion from which she'll never recover. She tried to go back to her job. She couldn't. She was an information architect making $100,000 a year. So if we're right, a jury might give her millions of dollars. She's like 32 years old. She can't go back to work. Was making 100 grand. They said she's crazy. She's exaggerating. She's malingering. Okay, she bumped her head. She had a concussion. We'll pay her a few bucks. We're not paying her millions of dollars that Rothenberg wants. He's crazy. So for years, all I ever heard every time we had a conversation, we'll never pay you, we'll never pay you, we'll never pay you. Suddenly when we had a firm trial date, it was, we might pay you. We're gonna think about it. So can we go to a mediation? Yes. A mediation means you go in front of a retired judge and each side does a presentation and then the judge splits you up and comes to me. Harry, come on, you gotta knock down your demand. Runs over to them, come on, you gotta offer more money. Runs back to me and tries to, if he can make the numbers meet, the case will settle. Now I knew that this client, I believe due to her brain injury, they believe because she's just bananas, could never make up her mind. Like she would show up for the depositions, which took many, many days, with three different cups of coffee, like, you know, black and one with sugar and one with cream, because she just couldn't make up her mind. So I knew, I can't wait till the day of the mediation to spring numbers on her. So a month and a half beforehand, I called her up, went through all the possibilities. And I said, they're gonna offer some money, so here's my recommendation. And I don't know whether they'll get anywhere near these numbers, I don't know. If they offer you less than $1 million, I think we should reject it. If they offer you $1.5 million, my fee's a third, also cost, but let's just keep it simple, that'll net you in your pocket about $1 million. I think you should take that. I think that's too much to risk. And between $1 million and $1.5 million, it's really your decision. I'm fine either way. You want to take it, that's fine. You want to go forward, that's fine. It's really your decision. And I went through, I told her the numbers, like at $1.1 million, you'll net this amount. At $1.2 million, this amount. $1.25 million, this amount. So I gave her all the numbers. I said, think about it. She called me a day or two later. Okay, can we just go over the possibilities again? Went through it over again, okay? A few days later, went through it over again. I call her a week later. Have you made a decision yet? I'm still talking to friends. I'm still talking to my family members. I'm still talking to my father. Okay, it's getting closer. Finally, the week before, she calls me. She says, okay, I take your recommendation. I said, meaning? She said, if they offer $1.5 million, I'm going to accept it. I said, what about between $1 million and $1.5 million? She said, you know, I'm not sure. I said, oh boy. Okay, here we go. Hashem, please let me get to $1.5 million. So we start the mediation, 9:30 in the morning, and as the day goes on, they're offering 150, it's 225, it's 250, it's 300. Did I hear 400 in the back? Does somebody have 4? It's like selling Elias, you know, in Simchas Torah, whatever, right? Or other chagim. Like 500, 650, 750, 800, 900. Is somebody willing to do $1 million? $1 million. That's always a big deal to cross the magical million line. $1.1 million, $1.2 million, $1.3 million, and the judge comes in, very, very well-respected judge. And I've been in front of him many times before, no nonsense judge. He sits me down and he says, Harry, they've made their final offer. I said, yeah, $1.4 million. And I remember thinking, Hashem, don't do this to me. Just Hashem, don't do this to me, okay? I said, there's gotta be more. He says, it's not, that's it. I can't get another dollar. I said, can I speak to them directly? He said, sure, there's no rules, it's in trial, it's mediation. He goes in, he says, let me ask them. They said, fine. So I go out in a separate room with the defense attorneys. And I say, guys, let me tell you what's going on. You know, we have a debate as to what the cause is, but you know my client has extraordinary difficulty making decisions. We've been going through this now for more than a month. So I'm going to lay all my cards on the table. I have a number. You are so close to that number. If you hit it, you have a settled case. If you don't, it's not a settled case. I'm asking you, get together, dig deep. There are a couple different layers of insurance coverage. Dig deep. You got to come up with this number. So I tell them, what number do I need? Is anybody paying attention? 1.6. Why? Because I know that if I say 1.5, the chances are they can't resist. Because what happens if I say 1.5 is that Shlomo HaMelech shows up with his sword. I'm ready to cut the baby in half. That's what almost always happens. Like they can't help themselves. They always want to divide it in half. So to leave myself room, I say 1.6 so that if they divide it in half, I got my 1.5. They huddle up again for like another 45 minutes. They come back to the mediator and he says, Harry, 1.6. Settled case, okay? I go in triumphant to the room and I say to her, I have great news, congratulations, case is settled. She says, what do you mean? I say, they offered $1.6 million. She says, how long do I have to decide? I said, well, what do you mean? I mean, it's 1.6. That's more than 1.5. Like, you said 1.5. This is 1.6. Okay, she says, no, I know. I just want to call my father. No problem. She says, could you excuse me? Okay, I walk out of the room. Okay, no problem, right? just tell the guy, you know, she's calling her father, no problem at all, great. You know, the mediator's writing up the settlement agreement. So I go back in, about 15 minutes later, she's on the phone. She says, I'm just talking to my brother, okay? Just excuse me. No problem, okay, well, guy. I just start, after an hour, it's now like 5 o'clock, the mediator says, okay, listen, look, I've done my job here. I wrote up the settlement agreement. If she, you can stay all night if you want. We will not turn the lights off on you. If she accepts it, sign it, and leave it up at reception. If she doesn't, rip it up, okay? And he leaves at 5 o'clock, 5:30, 6 o'clock, 6:30. And I keep checking in every 15, 20 minutes. I'm speaking to my father's friend. I'm speaking to my brother. I'm speaking to my sister, okay? At 7 o'clock, she's taking a nap, okay? So I don't have to report back to a half dozen lawyers and adjusters who have been there since 9 a.m. that she's taking a nap. So one of them absolutely goes berserk. Wait, what are you, wake her up, okay? The other one says, no, wait, wait. Maybe she'll wake up refreshed and ready to settle. I was like, yeah, exactly, okay? 7:30, 8 o'clock, 8:30, at 9 o'clock. 9 o'clock. Been there 4 hours, okay? She decides, yes, I'm going to settle the case. Great. I sign it, go back into the other side. Guys, have at them apples. You got a settled case. Everybody cheers, and we all go home, okay? Unbelievable. I call my wife on the way home. She's like, what happened to you? I said, I've been in a mediation. She goes, I know, but usually, you know, you're home before 10 o'clock. I mean, how long? I said, you're not even going to believe the story. I'm too exhausted. I'll tell you later. Fine. So I get home to a very, very, very late dinner, and I tell my wife the story, and I say, it's obvious to me that Hashem was trying to send me a message. It's obvious. Like, what kind of crazy, like, Hashem wanted the case settled, right? I have a fee on that. It's part of my income. Hashem could have just had the case settled at 5, 5:30, 6, even 7. Like, what is he trying to tell me 9 o'clock? And I say to myself, I realize what he's trying to tell me. What Hashem is trying to tell me, this is a very important lesson, is don't take things for granted, okay? She can't make a decision. I can make decisions. I'll give you an example. Every morning when I come home, after davening, learning, I come into my breakfast, you know, pantry, and I open up the cabinet, and we have every possible cereal. Of course, they're all open. Why kids can't just finish one before opening the next, I don't know, but they're always all open. They're like 8 open boxes. You have to see the boldness and the quickness with which I make decisions. It's just honeycomb day, okay? The next day is cornflakes day. The next day is Honey Nut Cheerios day. I make big. So I said, obviously Hashem's trying to show me, be thankful, you take it for granted, you can make decisions. This woman can't make a decision. So I go to sleep that night. Whew, I have learned the lesson. I wake up the next morning and I realize, what a coward. That was the lesson that Hashem was trying to tell me. I get that lesson every single day at work. I have people who can't see, who can't walk, who can't eat, who can't do, I constantly get that. I have to be a special, be thankful that you can make decisions. Every day I get, be thankful that you can walk and talk and breathe and eat on your own. That was not the lesson. And I realized what the lesson perhaps was, and it's a scary one, and I'll leave you with this. Maybe the lesson was that Hashem is saying, you know, you're sitting back saying, whew, so glad I'm not like her. So glad, you know, I'm able to make decisions. Maybe, big talker, you should aim to be more like her. Maybe the next time the Sultan appears and starts whispering in your ear, don't do that when you know you should do it. Or do that when you know you shouldn't. Maybe you should say to him, you know what? Wait right here. I got to call my dad. You know what? Hold on a second. I got to call my Rav. Wait, wait, 1 second. I just want to run it by a friend, okay? Maybe that was the lesson. You see what she did. Over and over and over and over. Don't fall prey to that, to temptation, to the Yetzer Hara. Stop and think and talk about it, okay? So I leave you with that. Thank you for listening.